be here, and with the teaching, this is part of the graduate school preparation. They do teach you to teach every possible subject in Russian history, from Vladimir to Vladimir, inclusive. So, and that's essentially what, you know, why I'm teaching this year-long survey at University of Wisconsin-Platteville. We start with the Vikings, with the Varangians, and we end with Yeltsin. And it, this the survey course goes from September to May, and that's part of my responsibility at the history department there. So today I'm going to talk about military propaganda in Orthodox Russia. That is military propaganda that was delivered by the church in Russia, in Imperial Russia, early Imperial Russia, from roughly Peter the Great's time till the end of the Crimean War. And I will discuss various wars along this way and how the propaganda fit into each one of these military conflict settings. And if I have time at the end, I will talk about Crimean War, but I know as things progress, you know, one has to watch out for the time constraints. My paper addresses the issue of the use of military sermons in early Imperial Russia as form of military propaganda. Now, why sermons as a form of military propaganda? Why even bring up the church when we talk about military propaganda? Well, it is because military sermons had been the most widespread form of disseminating patriotic appeals, information about battles, information about commemoration of military events in early modern Europe, even in 19th century or late 18th century Europe, and of course in Russia. And also because in many cases, such as many parts of Russia, this was the only form of propaganda that would be available to the larger population. To illustrate this, let us imagine for a second that we're not faculty and students here, but are peasants living somewhere in Tambovskaya or Orlovskaya gubernia. Now we are mostly fully literate, mostly uneducated. How we are going to learn about military events that our homeland engages in different parts of the world? Why should we care about wars fought in the marches of Finland? Why should we care that our sons are sent to die in Crimea? Why should we care to pay harvest taxes so that the Tsar is able to raise an army to go fight in East Prussia or take Berlin or take Paris? Well, the answers to these questions and more would be found in the church, in the town cathedral, in the village church, if we are in the village, but particularly in town cathedrals, where official military sermons that were printed in St. Petersburg by the Holy Synod were sent to the priests to be read in the parishes during the times of war. And they were mostly read after the liturgy, and many people, if not the majority of people in these services, were illiterate. Remember, this is before the advent of mass literacy, before the newspapers are mass media in Russia, before cinema, before radio, and certainly before CNN and Fox News. Now, in fact, the same held true for many countries in Europe during this time, even the ones that had mass newspaper. As a genre of propaganda, military and state sermons dominated both the spoken and the written media in most European countries for most of the 18th century. In England, for example, the sermon was the most widespread form of printed matter in the 18th century, according to the findings of the dissertation of James Caudle. No other form of printed matter or printed sheets of paper or printed media had surpassed in number of publications to that of the sermon in England in 18th century. So even there, sermons were very, very important, including, of course, military sermons that were delivered during in the churches during this time in Britain and English-speaking world. In Russia and Western Europe alike, most of the military propaganda was delivered by the churches during this period of time, starting with the court bishops, who were preaching sermons to the audiences of the monarch, the senate, the nobles, the officer corps, on grand occasions of state ceremonies, peace treaties, battles, wars, and so forth. These sermons enjoyed wide circulation. Here's an example of one of the military sermons from Theopan Prokopovich that is printed right after the victorious battle in Granja, when the Russian Navy had defeated the Swedish Navy, and immediately circulated and printed out and circulated to various parishes in various urban dioceses in Russia. Now, here is an example of 18th century sermon of Metropolitan Ambrosius Vodovedov that was printed and circulated also during this period of time. Many of them also circulated in manuscript form. It was not just that, you know, that these sermons were just printed and were available only in that form. People copied them. There was a shortage of printed books in especially late 18th century Russia. So people copied them, and in RGB we have just literally cases and cases of these manuscript sermons where, you know, people copied them down and read them, especially preachers in more village parishes, in more rural parishes. They would copy them down. They couldn't afford or didn't buy an actual printed copy, and then they would preach from that. In many countries of Western Europe, preachers utilize religious rhetoric to advance a kind of a sectarian agenda of their own Christian denomination or their own worldview. And this would hold a major difference between Russian sermons and the sermons in Western Europe. The question is largely in the content and the focus and the religious focus in these sermons. If we look at the sermons during such key events as the Wars of Austrian Succession or the Seven Years' War in 18th century England and Netherlands, just looking at those sermons, you cannot but notice the profusion of references to the so-called stereotype of popery, to preachers like Benjamin Harris, John Hume, William Shurgler, described the war effort as a battle against Catholicism. The British war against in the Seven Years' War was a religious war against papists in general. Similar rhetoric appeared in North America, where the sermons of Jonathan Edwards employed stereotypes of Roman Catholicism to uplift the military morale in 1750s, while numerous Massachusetts divines praised the 1762 siege of Havana as a victory of the true church against popery. So again, these references to the so-called papists, the so-called popery, are all over the sermons that are found in England and North America in the 18th century. In France, bishops at the court in Versailles used religious rhetoric to justify wars with their northern neighbors as well. If we look at sermons of Jacques Benin Bossuet, who was praising the combat of the great Condé Louis II de Bourbon as a war against heretics in the Dutch Wars, and later in the Nine Years' Wars against, also this was a war against the Dutch heretics. The French were formulating and conceptualizing their war as a religious war, going against the Protestant Dutch, going against also the Protestant British and so forth, the heretics and sectarians. You see that also in the sermons of Jean-Baptiste Massillon as well, also 18th century. Swedish state sermons, however, constituted a major exception to this European pattern. Swedish Lutheran military sermons in the 18th century, for the most part, avoided designating adversaries as heretics or enemies of religion. Reference to the papal threat were mostly non-existent during even the Great Northern War, the war fought by Charles XII in Eastern European campaigns, and remained rare through the rest of the century. And moreover, the kingdom's church law prohibited the clergy to comment on the matters of military policy or military strategy in their sermons. And so the sermons did not focus on presenting enemies as heretics or wars as wars for religious purpose. Now, what about Russia? Well, if we look at Russia before the Peter Petrine era, before start of the major reforms of Peter the Great, we have a similar picture. Russia is, and Russian Orthodox army and soldiers are fighting a war that was essentially a religious war. If we look at sermons of Patriarch Germanian, whose statue was put up with Putin's approval in 2012. It's a very, very sort of anti-Polish, Polonophobic edifice, especially on these sides here. But anyway, Germogen, his sermons very much blasted the Poles and the Lithuanians who attacked or who were in Russia at this time with false Dmitry as heretics. And this was a war for faith. This was a war to liberate Russia from heretics, and these heretics were Catholics. Up until Petrine era, this is what we see in Russian sermons of this time. And even in 1700 and 1710s, we have Metropolitan Stefan Yavorsky, who is the head of a Philo-Catholic, that is anti-Protestant, party of bishops at the court of Peter the Great. He had both the Philo-Protestant and Philo-Catholic parties, and he was also referring to Swedes on many occasions as heretics, but he was the last in the trend. After his death and after sort of the dissipation of the Philo-Catholic party at the court of Peter the Great, the clerics in the Russian Orthodox Church from this period on do not refer to the enemies, the European enemies of Russia, as enemies of church, as enemies of the faith, and do not refer to justifying war in religious terms at all. So how do they portray the enemies, the European enemies of Russia during this time? One particular image that comes in these sermons over and over again, and this goes on from Great Northern War all the way up until the Napoleonic Wars and beyond, is the image of a just and unjust fight with references to classical and biblical characters, but in particular David and Goliath. Here you have an illustration of David conquering Goliath. This is from Russian Bible of 1751. So when the Russians were reading the Slavonic Bible, those ones who could read, they will see these illustrations in this particular edition published in St. Petersburg in 1751. And so the image of the enemy was given in the usage of rhetorical mechanism of showing biblical characters and showing classical characters, but not in constructing Russia as a sort of the island of orthodoxy that is juxtaposed against the sea of heresy. There was no reference to that. In fact, Russia was presented as an ecumenical Christian power, as a defender of ecumenical Christian interests in Catholic West and in Protestant West alike. As examples of sermons during the Continental Wars will demonstrate, Russian bishops viewed the empire as a part of their wider European Christendom, a participant in its system of alliances, and even a defender of its wider religious interests. This ecumenical embrace of Europeans as non-heretics had continued up until the Crimean War. However, it stopped at just designation of Europeans as non-heretics. The sermons from the Russo-Ottoman Wars, the wars with Turkey, demonstrate a very, very different narrative, something that I'm going to talk about as well. So let us turn to the first part, the Goliaths, who were the non-heretic, strong, valiant, but nevertheless threatening nations that fought against Russia during this period of time. And we are going to start, of course, the Great Northern War. This is a war where Peter was able to literally push himself a window into Europe, which was the window into the Baltic Sea, defeat Sweden, the ascending, rising empire at this time, that whose ascent was halted by Russia's successes, and also dictate new terms to Poland, Lithuania, that eventually led to the dissolution of Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth. This was a very important, very crucial war in the foundations of Russian Empire, and it was essentially the longest continuous war in the Imperial Russian history. If you look at all the sort of wars that Russian Empire fought, this is the longest continuous war. Now, the Great Northern War coincided with reforms that Peter was carrying on both in the political and economic sphere, but that allied bishops who were educated in the West, bishops who were quite friendly to the idea of reforms, were also carrying out a reform in the religious sphere. Here we have the the leader of the Philo-Protestant faction of the Russian Orthodox Church, Feofan Prokopovich, who was referred to by his colleagues in Halle, Germany, where he studied, well, he visited actually, he did sort of study through self-study there, as the Martin Luther of Russia. So if Russia ever came anywhere close to the Protestant Reformation, it was the Petrine era and Catherinian era in the 18th century. And so we have Feofan Prokopovich, who adopted Protestant theology to transform not only Russian doctrine, what Russians believed in, but also to transform such issues as education. For example, he adopted Martin Luther's catechism to become the standard catechism, the standard catechism slash learning module for the early childhood education. And this is known as Первое учение отроком. That's his publication. So anyway, a large number of sermons printed during the time of the Northern War were sermons delivered by Feofan Prokopovich and his friends in the Philo-Protestant party. The military sermons that he preached and that were preached by his colleague Gavril Buzhinsky gained much printing, official printing, and circulation. Both Feofan and Gavril accompanied Peter during various campaigns. But Gavril himself was also an Ober-Hieromonk. That was a title in the Russian Navy. Ober-Hieromonach, which means that he was sort of the bishop of the monks of the Navy. And preaching literally at the ships, he would preach to the sailors. He would be traveling with on the naval expeditions. Now, in Russian army, the priests who were married, the white clergy, would be reserved for the army. But on the ships, they would not allow priests. They only allowed monks. That was sort of the general designation for the way the army chaplaincy was organized. Now, both of them preached quite a number of sermons during this period of time. And in their sermons, they sought to rouse the patriotic feelings of audiences, offer plausible and logical justifications for the war effort, but largely shied away, or all of their sermons shied away from using sectarian rhetoric. Justifying the war effort to the audiences was one important task that we see in their sermons. Both bishops viewed the origins of Swedish aggression in Europe as stemming from jealousy. They argued that Charles XII became a jealous Goliath, who was also very much upset with the successes of his neighbors. He looked at Peter coming to power, and he became jealous of Peter. He looked at Denmark, and he got jealous of Denmark. And this jealousy led to a war in Europe. That's how a war was explained to the sailors who were sailing with Buzhinsky on these ships. Then he also advanced theological argument why Russian servicemen needed to shed their blood for countries like Denmark and other countries that were fighting Sweden this time. And one of his sermons preached in 1714 at the dockside near Gulf of Botnia, what's also known as Hanko or Hangud, or Gangud in Russian, defined the argument that other nations, the other European nations, were brothers. And just like Abraham fought a war for his brother, Lot, so should Russia fight for its brotherly nations in Europe and liberate them from the Goliath, Charles XII, who was the terror, and I'm again quoting here, the terror of the Europeans, end quote. And Russia was their only savior. Not only were Russian troops told to fight for their brothers in Denmark and so forth, but at the same time, he argued, Russian soldiers were fighting to preserve Lutheran, Catholic, and Orthodox, quote, holy churches against the cruel Goths, end quote. So again, he argued that Charles XII was not respecting the faith of Lutherans and Catholics in places like Silesia, and he brought up concrete examples. It wasn't just he was saying, oh, you know, you should fight because he is plundering Lutheran churches. He was saying, look, he was plundering Lutheran churches in Silesia, so we need to defend their interests as well. The bishops employed the metaphors of David's and Goliath to present Russia as this weak, self-defending victim of a stronger aggressor. The primary and most noticeable Russian weakness in the sermon was military one. In 1717 sermon, both Prokopovich and then in another sermon, Buzhinsky highlighted the fact that Russia had very little education, had very little advancement in military, in naval rules. It had no navy up until this point, and so on. Sweden, on the other hand, was the most martial nation in human history, they argued, surpassing even the Spartans. So that's how strong Sweden was. Cold climate and northerly location was the main cause of Sweden's strength. So be thankful for this climate. It makes you stronger, like it did to Sweden. Cold weather and its status as, quote, the most northerly nation, argued Prokopovich, turned its citizens into being tough like iron, like the glorious Swedish iron. And if any of you are wondering how tough the Swedish iron is, you should drive one of the 240 models of Volvo. So, anyway. Therefore, Swedes possessed the inborn talent, Prokopovich argued, that made battling and winning wars rather easy. And I'm quoting from his sermon, "For them, fighting is like going fishing, where fish is already stocked," end quote. So Swedes were natural to fighting, and they were living more to the north of Russia, therefore they're much hardier than Russians. Second most important Russian weakness was the fragility of its allies. In his Poltava homily to commemorate the Battle of Poltava, Prokopovich reminded the audience how in 1709, most of Russia's continental allies, Saxony, Austria, and Polish King Augustus, were either defeated or knocked out of the war, while Sweden enjoyed Polish alliance and the help of the Ottomans and Ukrainians. So Russia was weak, it was less tough than Sweden, and now it was abandoned by its allies. In light of these numerous weaknesses, Russia's victorious rout of Sweden was obviously a miracle in the ways these sermons presented Russia's war. And again, copious comparisons to David and Goliath are seen here. One of these sermons delivered on the Battle of Hangut or Hanko in 1714 emphasized the fact that the Russian navy was composed of very small ships, and yet they were able to defeat the Swedish navy, the larger Swedish battleships, and even captured the rear admiral Nils Ehrenschild. So here you have a painting of the battle. Another one was the Battle of the Noteburg, the Nut Fortress, where Russians were so weak that they could not crack this nut, they could not attack it, and there was a huge moat that Russians could not fill. They would build, they lacked technology, they lacked staircases to force the moat, and eventually they were being pounded like lions, sheep being eaten by lions, and Russian soldiers being thrown into a moat, and then they were able to storm it. So, despite painting the Swedes as vicious lions who terrorized Europe, Russian military sermons reserved some positive imagery for Sweden, both before and after the Treaty of Nystad in 1721. First of all, Swedish jealousy towards Russia, while hostile, was fraternal, paradoxically so. Only brothers are jealous of brothers. Normally, you're not jealous of a person you don't know or have no relation to. That's what Prokopovich argued. Therefore, Swedes, hrabry svei, valiant Swedes, as he called them, were our brothers. And to drive that point further, he argued that Swedes is a nation that Russia should learn from. Russia should imitate Swedish military organization, Swedish technology, Swedish political system, and so forth. And in fact, the whole system of kollegi, the collegial system of government, would be taken lock and stock from Sweden by Peter the Great. Now, the use of biblical and classical imagery continued to dominate Russian military sermons in the wars that were fought after Peter's death. This is seen in the reigns of Empress Anna, who reigned from 1730 to 1740, and Empress Elizaveta Petrovna during the Seven Years' War. And so the two wars that I'm going to mention here now is the War of Polish Succession and then the Seven Years' War. Now, the first war, the War of Polish Succession, was fought when Feofan Prokopovich was still alive, and he was preaching quite a lot at the court, and he was preaching in diocese as well. And the majority during this time in 1733, Poland had a succession crisis when the Polish estates expressed a desire to elect an anti-Russian candidate, Stanislaw Leszczynski, who was a former ally of Charles XII. To Russians, this was unacceptable. How could these Polish estates, how do they dare elect a candidate that is not amenable to Russia or not friendly to Russia? This was tantamount to a declaration of war to many of them. And the Russians had their own candidate in mind, Augustus III of Saxony. And by the way, in the 18th century, majority of kings of Poland were actually came from Saxony. And Dresden was sort of the unofficial sort of capital of Poland. for some time. But anyway, they wanted to install their own candidate, Augustus III of Saxony. Russian troops crossed the Commonwealth border in July of 1733 in alliance with Austria and in alliance with Saxony. They started a war that also involved France. France began to support the Polish war fought by Stanislaw Leszczynski. Just like in Great Northern War, Prokopovich's military sermons presented Russian military intervention as a quote-unquote just war. One reason for this being just was that the Polish estates did not keep their promise. The idea was that when Peter the Great was alive, the Poles gave a promise to Peter that they would not elect an anti-Russian candidate. And this is what happened, you know, with Charles XII, and they had to come back to a pro-Russian candidate. In his sermon, he argued that the Poles had in fact forgotten this. They returned to their former excrement and their former puke. Second reason for the war being just was the fact that Poland, he argued, was scheming to invade Russia. We were a small, tiny David against a strong Polish Goliath. And why was the Russia a weak, tiny David? It is because during the 1720s, after the death of Peter the Great, Russia experienced a certain decline in the army and also in economy, and it's only in 1730s that this decline was sort of being overcome again. And so his argument was that it was only by Anna, Empress Anna, who was the new David and new Joshua, that Jerusalem, that is St. Petersburg, was being restored and rebuilt again. Because after Peter's death, Jerusalem, that is St. Petersburg, was neglected. So now we are still rising, but we're still in Babylonian captivity, and Poles are the strong Goliath who are trying to conquer us. And again, he also argues that Goliath, Poland is Goliath because Poland has the copious arms and treasury of France. That's something, oh, you know, they have French support and we don't have that. And France was arguably the richest nation probably after Britain in Europe in the 18th century at this during this period of time. So the theme of peaceful and weak Russia seeking peace for its neighbors and allies continued to dominate Russian sermons even during the Seven Years' War. And in the Seven Years' War, at the court of Elizabeth of Russia, Empress Elizabeth Elizaveta Petrovna, as she is known in Russian, the preacher that became very the most popular and whose works were published in greatest, printed in greatest number, circulated in greatest number in the dioceses, was Gideon Krinovsky. Gideon Krinovsky was a kind of an indulgent cleric. He really liked fancy robes, and he had a whole walk-in closet of fancy robes. He also had, he was wearing wig and face powder. Now, this was just, he was just starting a trend. After him, it was normal for bishops to wear face powder or to put on wigs and so on. And be indulgent in their wardrobe, but he was quite well known at the court of Elizabeth, and in his sermons he was trying to explain the nature of Russian war. According to him, the nature of war, of Russia's war against Prussia and against Britain during the Seven Years' War, comes from the actions of this one man. Frederick the Great showed an immoral vlastolubie, immoral lust for power, in invading the electorate of Saxony in 1756, inspiring England to also to invade French territories. Instead of being good to his Christian neighbors, Krinovsky argued in his sermons, these Christian powers, Prussia and England, wanted simply to, quote, enlarge their borders at the expense of neighbors, end quote. And these neighbors were Saxony and Austria for Prussia and French Canada for England. He also used another metaphor, saying that they were like children fighting over a bowl, the bowl being the globe. So that means this is a global war being fought in North America as well as Europe and also India. In his sermons, it was Russia's duty, he argued, to, quote, return peace to Europe and destroy the disruptor of common peace, end quote, as he called Frederick. Russia's purpose for entering war was to end it. Two key events bolstered Russian propaganda claim, or at least these preachers' propaganda claim, to being an Irenic peaceful power. One was the late entry into the war. Russia did not enter into the war until 1757. And it entered into what became known as the Union of Three Dames, Elizabeth, Maria Theresa, and Madame Pompadour. Bishop Krinowski interpreted this act as a proof that, quote, our peace-loving empress did not start fighting even as her allies start fighting, deciding to keep her arms at the border, end quote. So even if her allies were fighting against Prussia, Russia was patient in waiting, didn't want to fight the war, was very ironic. Russia was qualitatively different from those powers in Gideon's homiletic discourse. For him, the action demonstrated that you have a peace-loving empress that had revulsion to war. The new David's entry into the military conflict in the end was only, quote, forced upon her by the disruptor of common peace, that is the new Goliath, Frederick the Great. The second event that also helped a lot of bishops during this time to bolster the sort of the peaceful or ironic image of Russia happened in January of 1758, when Russians had taken over East Prussia, and the city officials of Königsberg welcomed Russians with a festive reception, opening the gates of Königsberg to Russians, inviting them, and essentially it was a peaceful conquest of Prussia, of East Prussia, by the Russians. And the Russian army entered with bands playing and bells ringing, as Krinowski mentioned in his sermons. Quote, what is normally achieved through arms only was achieved, what is normally achieved through arms was achieved with no arms altogether. God allowed victory without shedding of human blood due to Russia's desire for peace. So this was, again, for these sermons of this period, Russia is peaceful, it's ironic, and look how it is welcomed in East Prussia. Now, this is exactly what happened in January 1758 when William Fermor, his army, Russian army, entered East Prussia. Frederick ordered Königsberg to hold out until the end, but when they did not, he scorned them that their misbehavior was generally only expected of the Poles. So that's, again, Frederick's words. Now, so these are the images of Goliath, that is strong and mighty, but is not heretical by any means fighting against Russia. Now, the imagery of Russia's just wars and the theme of Russia's meek and weak status fighting against gigantic Goliath is something that will also be transcended into the Napoleonic Wars. And here you have one of the less obscene Napoleonic cartoons of the 1812 war. There are some of them that are a lot worse, especially from the British side, but this is a Russian one. So you have Napoleon here who just had a little bit of laxative, Russian laxative. So anyway, the theme of the just wars that was fought for the protection of entire Europe, salvation of Europe from war, dominated the sermons during also the Napoleonic France. Yet the scale of European theater in which Russia had to engage and the meaning assigned to it by European, Western European communities was also much more serious, much more magnified than in previous conflicts. If you had references to, if you look at British and North American sermons from war, 7 Years' War, and you see references to the papist threat or popery in Havana, now that's one thing. But when you look at the sermons from in Britain during Napoleonic Wars, you have references to the Antichrist over and over and over again. In fact, the pulpits from Mexico City to Hamburg, from New England to South Carolina, were proclaiming Napoleon to be the Antichrist. This was a common theme. The son of Satan, the great infidel, and all of that was quite common in the sermons of this time in Western Europe. And to think that, how is this going to affect sermons in Russia was one of my chief subjects of investigation when I was reading these sermons. And despite the rise of millennial anxiety and the emergence of sort of Russia's image of as a savior of Christendom, Russian Orthodox response to Bonaparte was rather reserved. We don't have the same sort of fury of sermons proclaiming a war against Antichrist. We do have literally individuals like Gavril Derzhavin and Vasily Zhukovsky who completely take the themes from the West and describe Napoleon as Antichrist. So that's why in Russian literature, War and Peace, if you have references to Napoleon as Antichrist, that's not from the church. They're not getting this from the sermons. They're getting this from popular literature that was being printed and written by literary intellectuals. And the sermons, in fact, delivered by bishops from 1798 to 1806 show no such reference. Archimandrit Filaret Drozdov, for example, the future Metropolitan of Moscow, spoke in very general terms about gloomy visions of war, suffering, fighting for the fatherland, but offered no explanations of causes or aims of the war. The bishop's silence on this issue, however, would break in 1806, when the failures of the Third Coalition to defeat Napoleon at Austerlitz failed and prompted Alexander to issue a call for public mobilization. What happened in 1806? Austerlitz failed, Russia was in panic, Napoleon was about to cross the Niemen River and invade Russia, and Alexander was calling on the popular militia to organize in the villages, in towns, to fight Napoleon. This is 1806. So during this kind of period of alarm and paranoia, he ordered the synod, the church, to issue a public statement. Now, the synod obviously was uncomfortable with this kind of a pressure, because they do have a certain theological outlook or worldview that they are cherishing at this point. This is post-Petrine church, after all. And so they did issue a statement in which they called for people to rise up in 1806 and defeat Napoleon. And this statement would later be repeated, although quite convolutedly, in the 1814 pamphlet in Russia called Duch Napoleona. So if you ever heard about Duch Napoleona, it repeats the synodal statement, but synodal statement is a lot more nuanced and has a lot more substance to it, theological substance. So what does the statement say in 1806 from the Holy Synod? Well, they accused Napoleon of very grave sins. First of all, Napoleon was an atheist. He's not a Catholic, he's an atheist, who, quote, abandoned the Christian faith during the God-hated revolution and now worshiped idols, human creatures, and prostitutes, end quote. So that's Napoleon. He's an atheist worshiping idols and prostitutes. Okay. Second sin, he was a Muslim. He converted to Islam in Egypt and preached, quote, Muhammad's Al-Quran Muhammad, Muhammad's Quran, end quote. Thirdly, he was a Jew who is aspiring to unite all Jews as a false messiah in order to overthrow the Church of Christ, end quote. For the sake of time, I'm not going to sort of go into all the details of the statement, but they're long and mind-boggling. But it's interesting, nevertheless, there's no mention of Catholicism or heresy of Western Church, just heresy of Islam or Judaism and heresy of atheism. But the statement did not come anywhere close, as some had hoped, that they would proclaim Napoleon as Antichrist. So he was essentially a Jew who tried to unify Jews, and by unifying them, maybe hoping that the Jews would proclaim him false messiah. But he would not proclaim himself as an Antichrist or false messiah. Now, it seemed like it's fine in 1806 to say that, but I'm going to go a little bit further in what happened in 1807 and how this got the church in trouble. Right after proclaiming Napoleon to be a Muslim, Jewish, atheist, false messiah in 1806, the church had to deal with the Treaty and Peace of Tilsit in 1807, when Napoleon was proclaimed the ally of Russia, when Alexander I made peace with a former monster at the border city of Tilsit, and they met at these rafts, literally, and they embraced at these rafts, and they made a peace agreement, which Russia eventually would begin to ignore and continue trading with Britain, which would spark 1812. But for now, this seemed like everything was rosy, hunky-dory, there's going to be peace in Europe. And this created a problem for synodal bishops. Pyotr Vyazemsky even recalled a joke, this is from the anecdotes of Alexander's reign, where the bishops were joking in the Holy Synod that we should perhaps tell the people in Russia that when Napoleon met Alexander, Alexander baptized him in the river. And therefore, he was not, he was not a heretical Napoleon, not Antichrist, but Jew, Muslim, atheist anymore. So, in fact, the key bishops of the era, like Platon Levshin and Augustin Vinogradsky, and here is a here is Augustin Vinogradsky, and I'm going to talk about Platon Levshin later in the Ottoman sermons. They were so embarrassed by the episode that the sermons between 1806 and 1815 refuse even to refer to any sort of messianic role that Napoleon had pretended to. And in fact, in 1807, Augustin Winogradsky has to essentially bury the whole issue down under a deep pile of words by preaching his pretty much what I would call a false alarm sermon in the summer of 1807, where he argued that Napoleon finally suscepted himself, Poznal, the mighty and the high hand of God. So Napoleon finally is fine. He is finally feeling the vanity of his designs. I'm continuing the sermon. He bowed his neck in front of Alexander, the greatest ruler on earth. So Napoleon had bowed his neck to Alexander. Napoleon had converted. He's recognizing the high hand of God. So this was sort of a way for the bishops in 1807 to whitewash and correct the earliest statements that they made in 1806 during this whole period of paranoia and before the peace treaty of Tilsit. So fast forward to 1812. Even after the start of the war in 1812, the bishops refused to label Napoleon in specifically religious terms. Instead of presenting the war of 1812 and 1815 as a kind of a crusade against false messiah, which what it was in Britain, it was a crusade against false messiah, the ecclesiastical propaganda stuck to much more traditional themes of humble, weak Russia fighting against, quote, arrogant and rude Goliath, end quote. Also arrogant Pharaoh was he also referred to, who walked through the countries filled with blood of his victims, plundered the universe in tyranny, while Russia, among peace and security, condoled the suffering nations, end quote. So again, this was an idea that he's a Pharaoh, the people of Europe are his slaves, Russia needs to go and liberate these slaves. No reference, no references to him as being false messiah anymore or leader of the Jews. At the same time, the sermons depicted Russia's victory as miraculous. While Russia's fight in Europe in 1812, 1815 was a brotherly war of liberating fellow Europeans and even the French people from tyrannical emperor. Meek David conquers proud Goliath, wrote Augustin in 1813 in his sermon commemorating the Battle of the Nations of Leipzig. Again, these sermons were always on current events. So when the Battle of the Nations occurred in 1813, the news traveled to St. Petersburg. Augustine is very, patient and waiting around the news. Once he got the news, he started, concocting these sermons, writing these sermons, and the sermons would be printed and sent around to parishes. So sent around to the town cathedrals. And so the idea, everybody now in the empire is learning about the fact that there was such a thing as Battle of Nations. Without the church, regular people know about Leipzig? So in 1813, he's preaching the Battle of the Nations sermon, Meek David Conquers Proud Goliath, highlighting that enslaved nations like Prussia, Austria, Saxony, and Württemberg successfully vanquished the invincible giant, showing the weak defeated the strong. And again, so he's referring to that theme again. All of the printed sermons of the 1812 and then 1813, 1814 cycle, the church cycle year starts in September, presented Alexander I as, quote, the savior of Europe, who returned peace, freedom, and happiness to the kings of Europe, restoring the God-ordained monarchies to the continent, end quote. Addressing Russian troops stationed in Paris in 1814, and again, Augustine traveled to Paris and addressed the troops there, and, clerics did that quite often, they traveled. He argued that he was telling, and this is not him, this is just a historical engraving showing a priest in Paris. He addressed the Russian soldiers there by telling that Russians had returned, quote, freedom and justice to the Parisians by liberating them from foreigner. And foreigner was a Corsican Napoleon. They argued Napoleon was not French. He was a foreigner, so you liberated him. Russians now also vowed to protect all the altars and prevent the sin of shedding of royal blood, an obvious reference to the revolution. An Orthodox country, noted the bishop, was now the guarantor of sanctity of pan-European Christendom and its legitimate loyalty, Catholic, Orthodox, and Protestant alike. Russia has become a continental, but ecumenical and distinctly Christian superpower. Now, this theme of Russian Tsar liberating the French from the Corsican pretender and being a protector of all Christians, Catholic and alike, is also shown, is not something that continues. This ecumenicalism does not continue in the sermons relating to the Ottoman wars, and particular sermons mentioning Islam. Military homilies developed, delivered on occasions of Russo-Ottoman wars, constitutes a sole example of wars of religion in the Russian homiletic literature. So we have here, we have several preachers during the Ottoman wars, during the later part of the 18th century that emerged with these kinds of sermons, but even before, but for the Beda von Nevshin, even in the time of Prokopovich, so I mentioned Prokopovich earlier, in Petrin era, the slogan of "for faith and the faithful" to describe Russian military effort in the Balkans emerged. For Brzezinski and for Prokopovich, this was a war for the cross, for the faithful, and to deliver Russia, the Orthodox of the Balkans, from the Hagarite captivity. Now, reading the sermons of Prokopovich and Brzezinski from the Balkan Wars, so the Prut campaign of, or later campaign of Peter, and comparing them to the Great Northern War is just like reading two different forms of literature. Because in one you have, you know, Swedes are noble, Swedes are valiant, so we are fighting them because they're Goliath, but we will learn from them later on. And you're fighting against the Turks, and the Turks are evil. They're enemy of Christianity. You'll go to heaven if you kill a Turk, and all of that. I mean, it's just completely different references. And so, the theme of religious war of liberation would be the dominant theme of military propaganda of Russo-Turkish wars, including particularly the war of 1768-1774, which culminated in the Peace of Kuchuk-Kainarja. During this war, Russian troops captured some key Ottoman fortresses in the Black Sea, and here you have some battles during this war, like Chesme battle, and they also were fighting on land in the Danubian principalities as well. Two bishops were particularly influential in shaping Russian foreign policy, clerical propaganda or ecclesiastical propaganda. One was Ambrosius of Novgorod, whose jurisdiction was St. Petersburg. St. Petersburg was under the Diocese of Novgorod at the time. And another was Platon Levshin, or Levshin of Moscow. Here he is. He's very enlightened here. You will never see a portrayal or a portrait of Patriarch Kirill today in like this. That wouldn't happen. But in 18th century, that was all fine, you know, to portray these bishops with these classical themes. So here you have, Platon Levshin of Moscow, and you know, this is just one of the many examples from this era. So, what did they say about for example, the campaign of Orlov fleet, the campaign during which the fleet led by the brother of Catherine's boyfriend, Orlov, they were Orlov brothers, to defeat the Ottomans and support the Greek Maniot rebellion of the 1770s. Well, he argued that this was a war against infidel Hagarites, deviant Muslims, and it was fought for Russian soldiers, officers to liberate Christian lands up to the walls of Byzantium. So taking Constantinople, liberating lands, reestablishing Orthodoxy in the Balkans was the goal. Now, you would think that because the Russians were liberating the Greeks, that in his sermons, Platon Levshin would refer to Russian to the Greeks in positive terms. Well, he doesn't. He argues that the Greeks are incapable of forming a state. So he says that a natural order of things makes a Russian nation, Narod, a lawful ruler, a obladatel of those regions. Once we liberate this region, it's not going to go to the Greeks. It's going to go to us. He argued. And then he also added to this, a Russian is better able to rule the humankind in general, just because we have this gift of ruling better than anybody else. And the Greeks are incapable of ruling. And look what they did to Byzantium, so we're not going to let them do that again. And so this was the ecclesiastical notions, however, about Russian strategy in the Balkans were actually quite in tune with the current, at this time, current plans that Catherine had. For the Balkans. Catherine actually planned to take over Constantinople and then put one of her sons, Constantine, actually on the throne of Constantinople. So this was kind of planned by Catherine in some ways. Of course, that didn't happen, but Platon's sermons were already reflecting a certain trend in Russian foreign policy that was circulated at the court. His sermons enjoyed a profound psychological effect upon his immediate audience, court nobles, admirals, generals, various members of the family. Here you have one of the paintings by Johann Kirstner, Johann Kirstner, from Pius Catherine in the Kazan Cathedral in St. Petersburg, attending, and this is before the Kazan Cathedral was remained into this sort of St. Peter's Basilica style type of church. And when she attended these sermons, occasionally she would show some kind of emotional response. She said, "Father Platon, this is the metropolitan, does to us whatever he wishes us to be. If he wants us to cry, we cry. If he wants us to rejoice, rejoice." One of his most influential homilies was preached at the commemoration, at the news of the Battle of Chesme. So when they got the news that they defeated the Ottoman navy in Chesme, Platon, right away got the sermon together and told Catherine and all the people in the St. Petersburg nobility to come over across Neva River to St. Paul's St. Peter Fortress. He said, "Come to St. Peter Fortress, I'm going to deliver a sermon." And so they traveled over there, and he gathered them at the gravesite of Peter the Great, at the coffin of Peter the Great. And he started delivering his famous sermon on the Chesme battle, essentially saying that, arguing that, look, this is what Peter did, and this is what we're doing. But one of the things he started doing is he started knocking at the coffin of Peter the Great with his staff and saying, wake up, Peter, look, we had no fleet, and now we have a navy. Wake up, Peter, we had been oppressed by the evil Muslims, and now we're at the gates of Constantinople. Wake up, Peter, and see what's going on." And so it made Catherine kneel down and right in front of the archbishop and then cry in front of the coffin. But according to the noble diaries from this time, one of the courtiers at this time, Razumovsky, Kirill Razumovsky, had started to become very nervous, and he said to his neighbor, "Why is he asking Peter to rise up? If Peter rises up, he's going to give it to all of us." Because they were so corrupt. But anyway, so this was these sermons showed to us the sort of the imagery in the Ottoman Wars. So I'm just going to do a quick pre-conclusion wrap-up on the Crimean War. Why Crimean War? Because in Crimea you had both the Western nations who are not heretics, Christian nations, Britain, France, and Sardinia, fighting on the side of heretic, Hagarite, infidel Muslims. And so it makes the sermons from the Crimean era very unique. Now, I didn't go all the way up to the Crimean War in my original dissertation. This is built upon one of the chapters of my dissertation. And so this is something that's kind of a work in progress in many ways. But Crimean War is unique in this regard, in the sense that you have now both the Ottomans and the Christians fighting against Russian troops. So I've looked at several sermons by Filarion Drozdov, the Metropolitan of Moscow, who's quite a known figure at this time. I've read some of the correspondence of Vasiliev, who was a priest in France during this war, and he was preaching or tending to the needs of Russian POWs in Toulon. So he's writing some stuff. And I also looking in Akentiy Borisov. He was the Archbishop of Tavrida. He was stationed in Odessa, but he traveled all over his diocese. As you can see, he has a lot of medals. This became a trend. They're collecting medals because the clergy were given medals, military orders, like the Order of St. Andrew. They would be given military orders by the Tsars. And I think it was St. Andrew Order, one of those orders, maybe St. George, where they were also given a sword along with a medal. And it was kind of funny for some of these bishops to cherish their sword, carry around the medal. Anyway, so Innocenti, who has lots of medals, very important guy, was an archbishop of Tavrida, of southern Ukraine, what is today southern Ukraine. And so he was, during this war, Crimean War, he was traveling all over the diocese. He was going to Theodosia, to Karasu Bazar, to Simferopol, to the cathedrals there, to the churches there, and he also went to Sevastopol. He was preaching in the makeshift travel chapels in Sevastopol, and of course in the cathedral in Odessa. This is the inside. The cathedral was built in 1808. It was already in this style when Innocenti arrived to the diocese. And so, judging from his sermons about the Crimean War, this is one of the some of the themes that I got out of the sermons that he preached during this time. So, one of the things is why we fight. This is what he was telling soldiers in Sevastopol. This is what he was telling soldiers in Theodosia. This is what he was telling to people in Odessa when he was preaching there. The war is fought for the protection of Orthodox Christians, so the same theme as we've seen before. To guarantee, and this is something new, prava chelovechnosti. I've never seen this in any sermon in the 18th century, but I guess in 19th century it emerges. Prava chelovechnosti for the Eastern Christians and freedom of conscience, which was trampled upon by the Ottomans, and also the friendship of between Russians and Hellenes, and he didn't say Greki, he said Yelini, which I thought was really, really interesting. It's a classical reference to the Hellenes, and so this was a war for friendship. And so it seemed obvious that we're fighting against the Ottomans here. We're not fighting against Britain and France. Now, he did explain the British and French participation in his sermons. So the British and French were obviously Christians fighting against Christians. It's sad. They're not heretics. They're Christians. And it's sad to see us fighting each other. The British and the French are still Christians, but they're spiritually weak. That's the one thing he was arguing, that there's a spiritual retrogression where they're going back to the Middle Ages. He said in the Middle Ages, Christians fought Christians. You have, you know, Florence fighting against other, you know, nations and so forth. He said in the 19th century, it's unacceptable. Christians should not fight other Christians. And we should not go back to the Middle Ages. But one interesting thing that he notes in his sermon, preached in 1855 at the cathedral in Odessa, Cathedral de Sabor, he argues that it is actually a good thing that the French and the British are fighting on the side of the Ottomans. Why? Because he says the Ottomans are izuvieri, they are these, you know, they're really depraved, and they will commit acts of blasphemy, of sacrilege, izuvierstvo against the Russian Orthodox, but the French and the British are holding them back. The French and the British are there to stop the Ottomans from plundering churches, to stop the Ottomans from destroying monasteries. And he wrote an example, which I haven't confirmed if this is actually happened or not. I would like maybe suggestions of how to confirm it. In 1855, the British and the French attacked St. Nicholas Monastery, or landed near St. Nicholas Monastery in Iberia, which is in Georgia, and prevented the Ottomans from plundering the monastery. So this is a good thing. These Christians are fighting and preventing the Ottomans. And he said, if it wasn't for the British and the French, the Ottomans would be like Tamerlane. They would be stacking up heaps of skulls and pyramids, committing all kinds of crimes, you know, that would not be possible there. So, concluding remarks, church hierarchs presented Russia as a kind of ecumenical Christian power, not a sectarian Orthodox island that's in the sea of heterodox religious enemies. Military sermons communicated the outlines of military events to the regular people. So we know what the people heard from the sermons. We know what the people even read, those who could read. And we know what at least the priests read to in these settings. And we know from the listeners who were upper classes, who wrote memoirs and letters, how they received those sermons. We do not know, however, how lower classes, I cannot answer the question of reception from the lower classes because they have no ability to write memoirs. They were literate. Homiletic literature of the Ottoman War shows that at least some of the patterns of Russian foreign policy vis-a-vis the port in the 19th century and World War I actually find their origins in the 18th century. We're talking about stuff in the 18th century that would be repeated in 1914. I find that fascinating. So I'll yield the floor for any questions, comments, rejoinders, rebuttals. Thank you very much.